September 1st, 1894, 12:30 a.m. Lying alone on his cot in the darkness, 9-year-old Bill Grissinger wondered what it was that woke him. Then it happened again. The house shuddered, the windows rattled, and the hall door creaked open. This time he heard his mother, Kate, getting up to close the door, and he went out into the hall to meet her. Together they stood silently by the west-facing window of their small frame house, peering out into the dark streets of Hinckley. On the northwest side of town, recently installed electric carbon lights illuminated the sprawling yards of the Brennan Lumber Company. The mill was quiet. The night shift was taking its midnight lunch break. But what Bill Grissinger would remember nearly 7 decades later was the odd color of the mill's lights that night. Usually intensely white, they had a strange reddish tinge he had not seen before. The house shuddered again as another gust of wind slammed into it, and his mother led him back to his room. He crawled back into bed and waited. Finally, he heard the familiar sounds of the mill coming back to life, the rumbling of the carriages carrying huge pine logs into the teeth of the blades, the chomping of the gang saws biting into the wood, the whining of the edgers trimming the boards. He felt comforted by the sounds, but he could not get back to sleep easily. His father was away on a 2-day trip, picking cranberries out across the Kettle River, and the house seemed forlorn without him. From time to time, another gust of wind struck the house. Down the hall, he could hear his mother singing softly to his younger sister, Callie, trying to lull her back to sleep. Across town, at about the same time, Clara Anderson was saying goodnight to her school friends at Belle Barden's house. The girls whispered in the darkness on the front porch, talking about the school year that would begin on Monday. A cluster of boys stood in the front yard, talking softly and jostling one another. It had been a long, boisterous evening of games and dancing and flirting. Earlier, they had rolled up the dining room carpet to provide a dance floor. Someone had taken out a fiddle, someone else a harmonica, and they'd reeled off song after song as the young people had formed into 2 squares and flung themselves from partner to partner, clapping and shouting, promenading and do-si-doing, stomping wildly on the bare wood floors. Finally, worn out, they had turned down the oil lamps, and sitting on the floor in a circle, Belle and her guests had played postman, a kissing game. Later, Belle's mother had laid out a late dinner on the sideboard: cold fried chicken, fresh baked bread, raisin pie, and cold milk. Now, well past midnight, each girl with a boy to show her home, Belle's guests began disappearing down the dark, dusty street, the boys singing school songs and whooping to one another, the girls shushing them. Clara Anderson told Belle she'd see her at school on Monday. Then she watched as Belle ran back into the house, where Belle's father, Jake, was already putting out the last of the lamps. At a little before 3 a.m., Emil Anderson sat on a bench at Hinckley's St. Paul and Duluth Railway Depot waiting for a train north. A strikingly handsome young man with a boyish face and dark, penetrating eyes, he wore a neatly trimmed, somewhat sparse mustache. He also wore the white, upturned shirt collar of a clergyman. Sitting in a yellow pool of light cast by an oil lamp above him, he pondered why he was waiting there on a railroad platform in the middle of the night. The guest sermon he had delivered that day in Hinckley had gone well enough, but he was nervous about the farewell address that he planned to deliver tomorrow afternoon to his own congregation up in Sandstone. He'd worked intermittently on the address for 2 weeks now, but he was distinctly unhappy with the results so far. Within a week, he planned to be back in Chicago starting his final year at a theological seminary, and he knew that after graduation he might never again see any of his parishioners. But for now, he felt strangely and urgently compelled to be back near them as soon as possible, and so, unable to sleep, he'd decided to start for home now rather than wait for morning. He figured one sleepless night wouldn't do him any harm, and he'd work more on the address as soon as he got home. At 3 a.m., the train pulled into the station, and Anderson climbed aboard one of the chair cars. Settling into one of the upholstered seats, he watched the lights of the lumber mill slip by on his left as the train pulled out of town. About 4 minutes later, the train slowed as it passed through a small brush fire burning on both sides of the track, but it was nothing more than one of the many nuisance fires that had been smoldering in the wooded swamps and peat bogs around Hinckley for weeks now. Since early July, fires like these, set by homesteaders clearing land or touched off by sparks from passing trains, had been flaring up and dying down all over Pine County. The train picked up speed, and Anderson sat back in his seat, humming Swedish hymns, trying them out for tomorrow. Within another 15 minutes, he was climbing down from the chair car at an unlit crossing called Sandstone Junction. From here, it was a 3-mile walk to the town of Sandstone and home. Slinging his rucksack over his shoulder, he set off into the dark woods alone.